All right, please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Dan from the Northfield Big Book Step Study Group.
Hey guys, I'm Dan James. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
I've done these steps as laid out in the big book with a sponsor, and I have two groups I'm involved with. One's the Northfield Big Book Step Study Group, where I'm the treasurer, and the Absecon Speaker Group, which is a one-hour speaker meeting just like this, same format, and over there I procure the speakers, and thank my friends for taking the ride up with me tonight. And you know, that being said, I try to stay in the middle of the three legacies of AA, and you know, just to qualify myself as a member of AA and involved with the three legacies of AA, because I try and stay in the middle, because I don't know when life's going to kick me in the ass, and then when it kicks me, you know, I want to get in closer to AA and not be on the outside of AA or the outside of those three sides of the triangle and get kicked out of AA, you know, in a sense of the words. Not that you guys are going to kick me out, but you know, when life kicks me in the butt, you know, I can get kicked closer to AA or get away from AA, and I'll, and AA saved my life. And I know today, if I don't stay in AA, you know, I'm a goner. You know, maybe a slow, miserable death, or maybe quick. I don't know though, but I'll be a goner. You hear it all the time up here at the podium, and you know, each speaker, in you know, his own language and his own stories, talks about the spiritual malady and how, you know, disconnected they felt from the world around me, and you know, and I could definitely identify with that when, you know, when speakers would talk about how they felt like how they were waiting for aliens to come pick them up and say, hey, we put you on the wrong place, or wherever it may be, you know. I can identify with that, because growing up, I just never felt a part of. No matter what I did, no matter what I said, no matter what I tried to do, I just never felt a part of. You know, it might have been, you know, I might have not felt a part of. Maybe it's because of my lazy eye and my severe speech impediment growing up, but I never felt a part of. So I was just an inactive alcoholic just waiting to take his first drink. You know, I seen what alcohol could do at a very early age. My dad was an alcoholic, and he died from alcoholism when I was around 10 years old. And I remember going to his house because he was in a coma, and we knew he was going to pass, and my sister's taking me to his house to pick up my things, and there was blood all over the walls at his house when we got there. And my dad was a violent drunk, and that blood on the walls, it wasn't because of, you know, getting in a fight or anything. It was because of his internal organs hemorrhaging out inside of him. And so I got to see what alcohol and alcoholism did to someone at a very, very early age. But that couldn't scare me away from a drink, because I guess maybe because of that feeling of just disconnect from everyone around me. You know, I was just waiting to pick up the first drink, and what I didn't really realize at the time when I did take that first drink, it was just that, you know, instead of like that, you know, why can't you really be my friend? Why can't, you know, why am I so different from you? Or just whatever, just going on in my head, you know, I took that first drink, and it was just a feeling of, you're my best friend. I'm just like you. I might even be better than you. I don't know. But all those mixed feelings, definitely growing up and my times before I got here to AA, and you know, I put down the drink for a little bit. Is, you know, part of me like when I first came to my first meeting and being in and out of rooms for a while. I come into those cold, hard, seated church basement, and part of me would want to be up here at the podium. My ego would want to be up here at the podium, and then the other part of me would just want to hide from all of you and just hide behind the chairs in the back of the room. I just couldn't get into life. I don't know how else to describe it, but every speaker really can describe that spirituality, that feeling of disconnect in his own language, his own word. And that's kind of mine. But I was just waiting to take that first drink. You know, normal age, like 13, 14, like most of us, you know, I picked up the first drink. I started getting in trouble very early on. But by the time I was in high school, I got sent to county and, like, I got kicked out of my mom's house and I started living on my own. But, I never put two and two together, but, I started in my senior year of high school when I got in a lot of trouble and I started to realize the path I was going down and I decided to try to change my life a little bit. I didn't identify myself as a drug addict or an alcoholic or anything yet, but I kind of realized the path that I was going down was leading me to it was going to lead me to nowhere, and I started to get scared, and then so I started pumping the brakes on everything that I was doing at the time, and not completely stop, but just pump the brakes. Looking back at that time, where I necessarily wasn't drinking or drugging every day yet, and if you would have asked me, I would have said I had control. I can look back at that time period and realize that I never really had control over it. That I did suffer from this allergy that they talk about in the doctor's opinion in our book. That once I start drinking, I got little to no control over the amount that I take in. That when I start drinking, that all bets are off. That I don't know what's going to end up happening. After I got in trouble, I decided to pump the brakes. I got put on probation, got a bunch of trouble, and so I started straightening out my life, and looking back at it, I never had that control. Like, I look back and I see, like I always tell the story where I went on this canoe trip with this work canoe trip when, I was in my early 20s at the time, and a bunch of us in our early 20s were going out partying, going out drinking like normal, 21-year-old kids would do. When I went on this canoe trip, I brought a case of beer, one for me and my canoe partner. And that should have said something, that's a little bit much, alone. But we're going down this creek canoeing, and about halfway through, there's this stop where they have like a rope swing and this tree to jump out of and, like a spot to party at. And by the time we got down there, pretty much all the beer was gone. I started yelling at my canoe partner. I'm like, what happened to all the beers? You drunk them, you gave them away. What happened to them? And then he starts yelling back at me, "You drunk them all. What are you talking about?" It didn't dawn on me, kind of how drunk I was at the time. And then I see everyone climbing up this tree and jumping out of the creek. It was like a deep part where you could do that. And I wanted to do that so bad. I started climbing up the tree, and then all of a sudden I feel all these hands pulling down on me, grabbing on my shirt, grabbing on my shoulders, and start pulling me down. They're like, "Dan, you're going to kill yourself. Don't go up there." Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, "What are you talking about?" Everyone's like, "You're wasted. You're going to hurt yourself. Don't do it." And then it starts. And then when everyone's surrounding me, scared for my life, it starts dawning on me, I guess I'm pretty wasted right now. I didn't even realize it. And then I'm thinking of ways to try and sober up because my determination, I set my mind on something, I've got to do it. How can I sober up real quick to jump out of this tree? And then at the time, one of the also things I was doing to kind of straighten out my life and turn my life around, I started boxing. So we'd always do I was used to doing these weird stretches and whatnot. And then I'm like, "All right, I gotta get my blood flowing. I gotta get my blood flowing, sober up." And then, so I start doing all these weird stretches, while everyone else is having, partying, having a good time, I'm off to the side, and then finally I do something where I fall on my face and I crack my nose open on the bottom of a canoe, and then that kind of sums up my drinking is while everyone's partying, I'm off to the side doing weird stuff like drunk yoga. But what I didn't realize at the time was that I suffered from this allergy, this phenomenon of craving that once I start, I can't stop. And you know, when I got here, my sponsor, you know, it's called an allergy, and you know, and he asked me what an allergy was, and you know, it's an abnormal reaction to something. Normal people don't react to alcohol that way. That like when I have a craving, that when normal people have a craving for alcohol, you know, they drink a beer or a glass of wine, take a couple shots, and that craving goes away. But for me, that craving just it just doesn't quite get satisfied. You know, whether it gets, you know, it might get intensified sometimes, but it just doesn't get satisfied once I start drinking. Like my mom, who's not an alcoholic, she's, you know, she has craving for a glass of wine, she drinks it and that's it. Like I have a craving for a cheeseburger, I eat that cheeseburger and it's, you know, the craving's satisfied. But with, you know, with alcohol, it just doesn't quite work that way for me. You know, my dad had that allergy too. You know, who was an alcoholic. You know, half my family was, my mom's side of the family, just all, you know, normal. You know, none of them are drug addicts or alcoholics. Everyone on my dad's side is alcoholic. Everyone. But my dad, you know, he also had an allergy for shellfish. You know, he eats shellfish and his face blows up. You know, I eat shellfish, nothing happens. You know, it's an abnormal reaction for him, but. You know, in the case of alcohol, you know, it's just not as simple as, you know, normal allergy, I just don't drink it, I just don't eat it, you know. You know, with alcoholism, it isn't that case, because it's also backed by this mental obsession, this unbreakable mental obsession that's beyond my power. You know, I look back, you know, how I said one of the things I did at the time was boxing, and my boxing coach at the time, he'd always tell me, don't drink a month before a fight. And, you know, I set out with determination not to drink a month before a fight, and it would never happen, whether I went maybe a couple weeks, a couple days, but I could never even set that just month right there. I remember this time I was coming back from a boxing match up in New York, and we're on our way back, and it's like, you know, it's getting late. It's like 1-2 o'clock in the morning. We're driving down the Garden State Parkway, and now that, you know, the match is over, I can drink now. I did kind of my job and stayed away somewhat. I can't remember how long it was, but it was long enough that that mental obsession was on me. And we're driving down Garden State Park. I'm like, hey, let's stop at the liquor store. I want to get a drink. You know, my boxing coach, we just got done driving through New York, and, you know, a couple hour drive. He's like, no, I want to get home and go to sleep like a normal person. He didn't say a normal person, but that's probably what he was thinking. And that's our argument back. I'm like, come on, you told me not to drink for this month, blah, blah, blah. Probably, I lied to him. I told him that it's been the full month, and it really wasn't. And then we start arguing back and forth, and finally he, you know, yells back at me. He's like, why do you want to celebrate so bad? You lost the damn fight. but with, you know, with alcoholism, it's just, it just wasn't that simple for me. You know, it took a lot of ass beatings for me to realize how desperate I was. And hopefully, you know, me being up here at this podium today, you know, I can help paint a clear picture of how desperate I was and how hopeless I was. And that today, through AA, through God, through doing these 12 steps, that I'm not hopeless today. You know, those 10th step promises, you know, restored to a state of neutrality. As long as I'm living in 10, 11, and 12, I can, you know, those promises come true. The 9-step promise, 10-step promises, you know, it comes true for me as long as I'm living in 10, 11, and 12, and I'm not hopeless today. But hopefully, as I tell my story tonight, that, you know, I can kind of paint that picture for you guys. But during that time period of a few years being on probation and trying to pump the brakes on everything, you know, things didn't really get bad back then. It wasn't, even though I got in some trouble and everything, and, you know, I had little escapades like I just described where I drank too much and everything, that desperation, that hopelessness didn't hit me yet. And then once I got probation, I was like, you know, because of me just trying to control it, and you know, and me trying to control, you know, alcoholism. It's just like some kid just like poking you, you know, as a little kid, like just teasing you for 3 years. Like, come on, just let it out, just let it out. You know, you want to just let it out. And but I got off probation. It's just like, all right, it's time to celebrate. It's time to party. Only problem is that party just did not end and could not end for the life of me. Within a few month period, I burned my life to the ground. Everything that I built up during that 3 years, I started two little part-time businesses. I had a girlfriend, and, you know, boxing and everything. And within 3 years, burned all that to the ground. You know, that one, just go out and party for the weekend, just did not stop. You know, talk about an allergy, just like, you know, I can't stop. you know, and that lasted for about a year or so. You know, that weekend lasted for about a year. And then within about a year and a half or so, you know, there's a couple of periods where I tried putting it down on my own, and you know, I pick back up, and I'm the king at just at putting it down. The problem is, I just, you know, the crux of our problem is I can't stay stopped. You know, I'd put it down. I tried putting it down every other weekend. I tried detoxing myself every other weekend, you know, on my couch, but I just, for the life of me, I just couldn't stay stopped. But I ended up in my first rehab, a little while after that, and I got out of rehab. I thought drinking was my problem. You know, I just put down the drink, and it's I stopped doing drugs, and it's okay. You know, problem solved. I just get a little break, and I can just go about my life. But I didn't understand what I was suffering from, what I dealt with, and the night I got out of rehab, I'm drinking, and you know, a couple weeks later, I got a needle in my arm again, and you know, just started to go downhill, of course. And back up a little bit. When I got probation, it didn't take long for me to realize I had a problem. But from that time where I realized I had a problem and I was trying to stop, about a 5 year period of, I like to say it's just me working my first step. I was trying to stop, I was trying different ways to stop, but couldn't stop. There's different ways of going through steps. I always thought, some people would, coming in and out of different meetings and rehabs and jails during that time period, I hear people talk about working on their first step and, writing on their first step. And for me, there's not any writing that could have worked my first step. My first step, there's no amount of writing that could have replaced the feeling of my mom kicking me out in the middle of the winter time, and then in the middle of the night, me banging on that front door saying, "Mom, please let me in, this cold out." You know, there's no amount of writing that could have replaced the feeling of waking up in jail with a hazy recollection of why I got there. During that time period of where I realized I had a problem to when I got sober, it was me working my first step. And but during that time period of 4 or 5 years or so was, it was a period of me being in and out of rehab, me being in and out of jail, me being in and out of consciousness from detoxing on my couch. I ended up in my second rehab. I was a little bit more open-minded, a little bit, listening a little bit more, but still didn't really realize what I was suffering from, and no one really drilled into my head. Even if they were able to, drill into my head and tell me really what I'm suffering from. I always thought like therapy would do it. I thought that you guys, coming into meetings was all about just me coming in and sharing all my problems about my day, and then somehow they magically disappear and somehow I'd magically feel better. And I would try doing that, and I tried doing that in rehab, and I just kept on picking back up, and I didn't know, You know, I thought you guys were full of it. I didn't think I was like you guys, because you guys could stay sober and I couldn't, because I thought, you know, like, I love the set aside prayer, you know, remove everything I think I know, I know about this program, because I'm one of those guys that were just, I know, you know, just like I thought I knew what AA was about when, you know, coming in and out of here. One of the best things I said was, or thought was, before was when I was in my last rehab, and I don't know how to stay sober. Like, when I was in my last rehab, like, all these, like, crazy thoughts were going through my head, like how can I actually stay sober this time? And I remember one of those thoughts being, maybe I can somehow check myself into rehab every 6 months or so, just as, like, a refresher course. But one of the best things I said, like, I don't know. And one of the best things I can still say today is, I don't know, because, you know, I can come in here and, you know, and think I know everything, and when really I'm just waiting for a new experience. Sometimes I need that. But yeah, I love that set aside prayer. I started going a little tangent there. But, I went to my second rehab, and then again I drunk the next day. I got out, and I went on like a week or so run. I detoxed on my couch again, and ended up moving into a sober house down in Ventnor, right underneath Atlantic City, and I stayed sober for about a month or so, just going to meetings. Raising my hand at every meeting and dumping all my problems on you guys, treating you guys like a trash can, just, here, take my problems from me. I'm going to share them with you. Please take them. But I stayed sober for about a month and then got kicked out of that house. And, at that point, my mom, everyone on my dad's side of the family had pretty much passed. And then my mom didn't want to have anything to do with me, really. I'm still her son. Like, she wanted to make sure I was safe. So she'd pay for, like, a room, like a efficiency apartment or a room in a rooming house or one of the crack motels going down Route 40 or something, just so I had, like, a place to, a place to rest. And, every once in a while I come home, I find a thing of groceries sitting on the floor. But she didn't want to have anything to do with me, and then I started about a year run in Atlantic City, and I was trying then. I was trying, like I was going to meetings, I was going to this outpatient program. I was on maintenance drugs, and I was trying all these ways, but I didn't realize how sick I was getting, there's a time period a couple years before that where I went to jail, and I was homeless at the time. I was broken. I remember going to jail and feeling this feeling of relief, like, oh, this run is over. Thank God. I can start my life over again. And then I remember going, and then after about a year running Atlantic City, I remember getting locked up, and that feeling wasn't there, like, oh, I can restart my life again. It was this feeling of just desperateness, and just this feeling of, like, why can't I stop? Why am I just continuing to live like this? I don't want to be this person that I am. I want to have a job. I want to have, I want to live a normal life, but I just can't. And I just didn't know. And they ended up sending me to my last rehab, and I was really trying in that last rehab. I'd do their step work and guide packets that they hand you in there, and sharing wherever I could, and participating in group, doing everything that I could. And finally I got out, and then I was going to move into another sober house near Atlantic City. And while I was waiting, to get into the sober house, I had to wait a couple days, and I was staying at my mom's house until I could get in, and then to make it simple, the obsession came back on me while I was there, found something at my mom's house, and I just could not
not drink, no matter how much I tried. You know, I knew I was going to fail a drug test for drug court that I just got put on for. You know, I knew I wouldn't be able to get into the Oxford house. I knew, you know, I knew all these consequences were about to happen if I, you know, if I took this drink. But I just could not take this drink for the life of me. I you know, doing all I could in that rehab, you know, all the well-intentioned people would, you know, they make a lot of suggestions, which are good suggestions, but there comes a time and a place where some of these suggestions just don't work for the alcoholic. You know, they say just call someone, just think through the drink. And I remember trying to take all these suggestions and me going back and forth from the toilet to flush it to the phone to call someone to the toilet to flush it to the phone to call someone. And I just could not take it. And, you know, it was a good, and, you know, and I thank God I took that last drink because it was, you know, it was an eye opener because when I look back at it, it showed how, you know, what powerlessness really is. You know, the powerlessness I always identified with, you know, people talk about once they start, they can't stop. Yeah. But, you know, I always thought that once I stopped, I could stay stopped. And, you know, that is the crux of my problem. I can't stay stopped, you know. But I got a good idea what, you know, that how powerless I really was and what powerlessness really is. And thank God I end up, they end up letting me get into that sober house outside of Atlantic City. And, they told me to come back in a few days when I could pass a drug test. But when I got there, I was going to another fellowship at the time. And at least the means I was going to, I really wanted to help, and you know, I was raising my hand like every meeting. You know, I need a sponsor. I'm new. I just got out of rehab, and I'm not really and no one's really reaching out to me. At least the places I was going, and then finally, after like a few week period of untreated alcoholism just starting to build back up in me, you know, restless, irritable, discontent, you know, fear. You know, just, you know, crippling fear, you know, having trouble with personal relationships, you know, all these problems that we have sober were just building up in me. And I was ready to just go to prison. Like I can maybe do, you know, I remember thinking I can maybe do this sober thing, you know, but I just can't live life. You know, just on the verge of snapping, I knew I was going to get locked up if I didn't make a couple meetings in a row, because for drug court, I missed a couple meetings to get my meeting paper signed, my meeting list signed, and it was a couple weeks in a row, and I knew if I missed meetings this week that I was definitely going to get locked up when I went back. And there's this meeting that I didn't know where it was at. I was trying to get to. I'm waiting for the bus to go where I didn't even know where it was going, and then the bus was running late, and I'm just on the verge of snapping, and a couple of my roommates ride by on their bike, and they go, dude, why don't you just get your paper signed at AA meeting up the road? And I'm like, oh shit, I totally forgot about AA. I can get my paper signed here. And then so I ran up the road real quick, just to get my paper signed. That was my only intention of coming to you guys. And it doesn't sound like much of a miracle, but really it just miracle happened. Like, cause I went to that meeting and really it was like a step two moment because I went there and you guys could all see that I was new, you know, you guys could all see that I was still sick and suffering, that, you know, untreated alcoholism just oozing out of me. It was like, I had a stamp that said, I'm a bad pickup, come help me. But after the meeting, you guys just all rushed me. You guys just all bum rushed me and just all showed me genuine love. And the meeting that I went to was just a bunch of old people too. And they were all happy and they had lives and families. And it was just, this is what sobriety is about. Like, you know, it just came to me like, this is what I want. Like, this is what I've been wanting. And I don't remember what that meeting was about, you know, what the format was of that meeting or the topic or if someone spoke, right? You know, I don't remember anything. All I can remember at that meeting is how you guys treated me afterwards. You know, I listened to a lot of speaker tapes. One of my favorite speakers, Chuck Chamberlain. You know, if any of you guys don't know who he is, old, old timer. Who's since passed. And he has a story of him getting asked to speak at this group. And at this group, there's this guy there for his very first meeting. And then, so he starts thinking before he gets up to the podium, you know, I really got to knock it home for this new guy. You know, I really got to help this new guy and knock it home there at the podium. And he gets up there, he does his thing, and then a year later, he gets invited back to that group. And then so he gets back there, and they notices that guy that was there for his very first meeting. And so he wants to know what he said that up there that helped that guy. And then so he goes up there and talks to him, and then the guy says to Chuck, something like, I don't remember, I didn't realize that was you up there. I don't remember what was said up there. You know, I just remember that everyone was nice to me here. And that's what got me, that's what attracted me to you guys. You guys had lives, you guys had families, you guys had this light in your eyes that I did not have and that I needed. End up getting a sponsor at that group, and he started taking me through the steps as they're outlined in the big book. We just started going through the book and we'd read together, and when it said to pray, we pray. When it said to write, we write. And in the beginning, I'll still shout out, mostly just because of selfishness, just me thinking about me all the time and just stuff going through my head. And, he'd be reading to me, and after the chapter's done, I couldn't remember anything what he said. But I do remember him talking about when we got to the third step, and he starts talking about prayer and how reliant he was upon prayer, and how he couldn't imagine his life, or how he couldn't imagine leaving his house without prayer, and it kind of struck me like these guys are actually doing it, like it's not like, these aren't like just fairy tales and whatnot, because I'm used to just the fairy tale God, like he might look, he might be up there, he might not, all these stories that they say in the Bible, and all the spirit, spiritual readings, it just doesn't sound real and just can't grasp it. But when he was talking about how reliant he was upon it, it kind of put things into terms for me, and he told me to start saying the third step prayer every day and come back with a notebook because we're going to start writing. And at first when I started writing, I wasn't I still wasn't the most honest and fearless and thorough. But I remember writing on everything and exaggerating on some things, minimizing on other things. Because I live my life as a lie. Like, I always wanted to feel connected to you guys. So like it was like, how can I be a different person? Literally like each place I lived or like ran or whatever, I literally had a different name like wherever I went. And finally when I sat down to do my fifth step with my sponsor, just something came over me where I got to stop living like this. I got to stop lying to everyone, and then I just came clean with all these things that that I told them that weren't true, and then I didn't read exactly what was written down on my fourth step to them. All the exaggerations and minimizations that I was doing. I started to actually tell them the truth and started to tell someone who I actually was instead of who I wanted to be. And, talking about Chuck Chamberlain again, he also talks about we have one problem and one solution. That one problem is being a separation from others and with God. And our one problem is a separation, feeling a separation from others and with God. And our one solution is conscious contact with others and with God. And, that's what I started to get. I didn't realize I was starting to get a conscious contact with God, but I started to get connected to another human being. I told someone who I actually was instead of who I wanted to be, and when I got to my fifth step, I left his house on fire. Like those fifth step promises started to come true. I felt like I was floating. He told me to put my hand on my fourth step, and it's time to renounce these things. Step six and seven, and And then start saying a 7-step prayer, my 3rd-step prayer every day. I was always scared of these steps, like coming in and out of rehabs and jail and meetings, and I was always scared of these steps, like you know a fearless and thorough moral inventory and making amends to everyone that I've harmed in the course of my entire life. Like, sounds pretty damn expensive. I'm not down with this. No, give me a drink. But I was always scared of them. But you know, I just get up in my you know it was just me getting up in my head, like. You know, I'd always make too big of a deal out of it. You know, it wasn't that hard when I was, you know, when I actually started to do it. And you know where the rubber really hit the road for me was when I went out and started making amends. You see, I didn't realize like these changes started to happen. In me, you know, other people started noticing at first, like. This one guy who's a really close guy in my network. After I started making amends, I remember him saying to me, he was like, "Dan, you changed recently," and it didn't really dawn on me, but it was like, I remember it was like one of those delayed action one of those delayed action OxyContins, like it didn't like hit me right away. Like a couple days later, I was like, yeah, something has happened. Like the rubber started hitting the road. I actually started to have a spiritual awakening. Like I started to think differently today. The way that I see you guys, the way that I was seeing you guys was completely different than it was a few months before that, or a couple years before that, or, you know, my entire life, I'm seeing the world differently today. And, you know, like all these cool things start happening. Like I always had this resentment with my stepdad. Literally since the very first time I met him, I hated his guts. Like I was probably like 11 years old or so. I come downstairs, you know, 11, 12. I come downstairs. I had a Jimi Hendrix shirt on. First thing he says to me was, "So you like shitty music?" Like, mother, you know. Literally, I hate him since the very minute I met him. And that hate went on for 15 years or so. But I went and made an amends to him, and that resentment disappeared, you know, right then and there. And we started actually, and then we actually formed we actually have a relationship today. Like, one of the things my sponsor warned me about when I went out and started making amends was he was like, "You may get some good reactions, you may get some bad reactions, and some of those good reactions might be that they might tell you that now that you're clean and sober, that just keep on doing the right thing, and that's enough of amends." And he told me, "Don't take that, you know, try and do something more." And my mom's husband, that's what he said to me too, was, you know, just seeing you change and, you know, and being sober, that's enough of amends for me. And you know, I didn't want to take that, you know. He always tried to find ways for me to help someone else, and then finally it worked out where he was like, "Buy me some fishing equipment. I want to start fishing again." You know, so that's what I went out and did. And I remember like 6 months later, he invited me to go fishing with him today. Like I started to build relationships with people, and with someone that I hated my entire life. I don't hate him today, and I don't have hate in my heart like I used to. You know, I got love in my heart today, and that's only because of going through the steps, you know, because of those experiences. But all these amazing things started to happen, and but not always all good things in sobriety too. A lot of bad things happen. This will tie in a little bit. Everyone's always looks at me strange when I bring this up, but I always love the movie. I love the movie Interstellar. Like the trailer to that movie kind of captured me, because it has like Anne Hathaway talking about love is the one thing that transcends time and space, and you know, like all these cool stuff about love. And I always thought of love being the higher power. One of the things, like when I was about 2 years sober, I got in a relationship with this girl who I absolutely loved. And we got engaged and she got pregnant, and I was on fire. I just been through the steps and starting to sponsor other guys and you know, starting to get my life back together. I'm about to have a baby with this beautiful woman that I absolutely loved, and I found out that the baby wasn't mine. And then it crushed me. You know, it went from this high to this low, and my heart started to fill back up with hate, and I just couldn't get over this resentment. Like, you know, I was doing constant inventory, trying to look at my part in it, taking all the suggestions like go to meetings and keep in touch with people in your network, get closer to AA, and doing all these things and constant prayer and inventory and. This resentment was going on for a couple months, I just couldn't get it, I just couldn't get this resentment to go away. I remember calling my sponsor or who's my now sponsor and asking them, hey, take me to a meeting tonight, I'm not in a good spot. And I remember taking this meeting and we're on the way and I'm crying in his backseat. I'm going off and this bitch, I'm gonna kill her, just waiting, all these nasty things I want to say to her. And he's not saying the word the whole time. Finally we stop at the stoplight, and then he just, with his monotone voice, his calm demeanor, we stop at the stoplight. He just looks back at me and says, "Dan, these are just all life exercises to trust in God." And then just keeps on going. It was like a bullseye, just bam. I realized that there's not a human power that can, relieve me of this resentment, that I gotta start becoming reliant upon God. Like my sponsor was talking about when we went over the third step. And that's what I did. I started just get closer to God. And I remember, that relief came to me in meditation one day where trying to look at my part in this, in my meditation that night. And it finally came to me where my part in it was love. Where not the internal emotion of love, but the outer expression of love. Where I was actually able to treat someone with love today, instead of looking back and being able to make this long list of my part in everything, looking at where was I selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and afraid, today don't get me wrong, there's a little stuff that came up like any relationship would, but my part was love today, I'm actually able to love someone, and that's a far cry from who I used to be. But I've had all these amazing experiences in meditation. A few experiences in meditation that really have changed my recovery like that. One just happened a couple months ago. Something happened where I was hurt and betrayed again, and something a little different. And again, just full of rage and resentment. And then in meditation, the one day, I'd gone to this meditation meeting out by me where it's really cool. We get into, it's a really deep meditation. And then I started meditating just on the word forgive. I started that meditation just, one half of me just full of rage, just ready to stab someone. Then the other half just wanted to break down and cry because of how hurt I was. And then I started meditating on just on the word forgive, and just this wave, this rush of all that rage and hurt just left me and just filled back up with forgiveness. And it was this amazing experience where it was like a reminder that God's still here, that God still has me. If someone would have told me that story when I first got here, I would have said, that's just God. You're just an idiot. You drunk the Kool-Aid. But whatever it may be, whether it was God or wasn't God, I think it is. It's this experience that just remind me that this program works. That when when life hits me, that I can rely upon this program, and you know, and it works. Now, I knew that that resentment was going to probably pop back up the next morning. I'm going to have to keep on meditating and doing inventory, but it was just a reminder that God's got me. But you know, today, you know, one of the most important things is me trying to help someone, and you know, and take another guy through their steps. One of the things that would often confuse me was, I thought that meetings were, in a sense, therapy. You know, I came here to get my relief, so to say. And today it's not, I don't come here to get my medicine today. You know, I come here to be of service or to find someone to help, come to be a service, whether it's going out and speaking or taking commitments at home groups or just helping clean up and keeping, keep an eye out for a new guy that, that looked like I did when I first got here, say, hey, what's going on? You know, I might be like you. I'm not anymore. But, not all 12-step experiences are successful, so to say. I was talking about this one time. I went to go 12-step someone that was sober, and go talk to him. Who I've been sober for about a year, because this guy had no steps in his life. He was just going to meetings and untreated alcoholism, building back up inside of him. And when I went to go talk to him, he couldn't imagine life. He was at the point where he couldn't imagine life with a drink or without a drink. And he had got to that point where, he thought that life wasn't worth it anymore, and he went out and killed himself sober. I always thought that that as long as I'm not drinking, I'm going to be okay. But I could totally identify with that guy, because there's plenty of times, being in and out of rooms where I was sober, but I just wanted to die. And then that also gave me a chance to actually, I got called to go on a 12-step call for his son who had, went out and relapsed too. And being placed in a position of maximum service to God and the people about me, that's my job, that's my purpose today. How can I be of service to you? And everything, and I try and stay in the mindset of what I do can, will it put me in a position to be helpful to you in the future? Life's good today. I got relationships today. I got friends today. I'm not fighting the drink today. Last year, my sisters threw a surprise 60th birthday party for my mom, and my sisters asked me to do a toast, and then I'm thinking of ways I can compliment my mom and. And then the St. Francis prayer came to me, that my mom lives her life like that's outlined in the St. Francis prayer, so to say. Like my mom is not an alcoholic. She doesn't need this spiritual guidance. This I love the St. Francis prayer. This the outlines of opposite of self. I seek that, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to love than to be loved, to understand than to be understood. These actions of opposite of self. I love that prayer. And it gives me a good outline to how I should live my life throughout the day. And that came to me, my mom, who's not an alcoholic, who doesn't suffer from a spiritual malady, she doesn't need that. She just lives her life that way. It doesn't need to think about that. Me, who I can get disconnected from you guys really quick. I need to continue to live by spiritual principles. you know, shoot towards that St. Francis prayer in my daily life. When I first got into AA, you know, I was confused about sponsorship, and I'd always think that sponsor was someone that I had to call every day, and that person was going to yell at me over the phone and tell me how I was doing everything wrong. You know, that's what I thought a sponsor's job was to do, was just tell me how I'm fucking up. And then, you know, when I went to that meeting and got a sponsor, I met this guy. He said, give me a call tomorrow. And I called him the next day, and he goes, what are you doing? Nothing. I just burned my life to the ground. What are you doing? He goes, I'm going to the beach. Want to come? All right, cool. That's a pretty good start to sponsorship. I was making a little too big of a deal out of the sponsorship thing the past few years. And we go to the beach, and we're sitting there, and of course I'm going off on all my problems. You know, what I think of God, what I don't think about God, what I think of AA, what I don't think about AA, what I think about NA, what I think about these treatment facilities. You know, just going off. And then finally he says to me, he goes, Dan, he goes, it's a beautiful day out. You got your feet in the sand. There's cute girls walking by in bikinis, and you're talking about all this crap right now? He goes, stay in the moment, kid. And this is the truth. I just needed to stay in the moment. Like, I just needed to stay in today. I'd always hear, live one day at a time, and I was just incapable of doing that, and that was just something that, you know, I needed to do. But how it just hit me dead in the head, you know, that, you know, just stay in the moment. I got when I look at life just a little bit differently, I got a whole nother world around me. And that's one of the beautiful gifts of AA is I always hear people talk about, you know, all these great things that they have, you know, this nice car that they just bought, and, you know, they just went on vacation to Hawaii, and like all these cool things, and like, you know, I never got any of that stuff so far in sobriety, maybe one day. But, one of the best gifts gift in sobriety today is the ability to do nothing, to just rest my head at night, to just be alone at perfect peace and ease, and not be caught up in my head and going stir crazy. That I can just sit there and quiet, and I'm all right today. And I want to thank this group for having me out. It was a pleasure.